My name is Valerie Payne, and this is the podcast Binding Unity. I started this podcast because of a personal experience that helped me to see the need for unity in our society right now. I hope that you will come along with me on my quest to find unity as we seek understanding, connection, healing, and love. Hi, my name is Valerie Payne, and you're listening to another episode of Finding Unity. And today I have Coralie Chulz here. She's going to be on talking about an eating disorder. So Coralie, thanks for being on and for being willing to talk about this. I feel like you're being very vulnerable.
Thanks for having me. It'll be a good experience, yeah. I think.
And I've known Coralie for a really long time, and I just found out like a month ago that you had an eating disorder. And so, I'm excited to hear your experience and just like insights that you've had during that. Do you want to first just tell people a little bit about your upbringing? I know you've lived in a lot of different places, so maybe, I don't know if you want to share that and what you do professionally.
Sure. So I'm from Gilbert, Arizona for the most part, but I've lived in a variety of places. I was born in Arizona when I was younger. I had the unique experience of moving overseas with my family for my dad's job. As a newly turned three-year-old, I moved to Taiwan. That's where my first memories of life are, where I can recall them from. And I lived there till I was age six. So I went to kindergarten and first grade at the American school in Taipei. And then we moved to the Philippines when I was seven, went through to the international school in Manila there through age nine through fourth grade. And then my family moved to Gilbert, Arizona. And I went through high school there. And then since I've been kind of up and down the West Coast a little bit for school, jobs, living in Utah, Washington, Southern and Northern California.
Woot woot.
Yes. Well, that's where I met Valerie, SoCal. And now back in Utah, just as of 3 months ago. And then I live in Lehigh. I work as an audiologist. So I'm a hearing healthcare professional, a clinical provider, and I spend my days doing lots of hearing testing and helping people with hearing devices, fitting them, adjusting them, helping them bring more life to their lives as they're able to connect to other people better through hearing better and communicating.
I love that. That's a great way to find unity, right? We have to be able to communicate.
For sure.
So if you're listening to this podcast too loudly, maybe turn it down just a little bit to make Coralie happy. Just tell us a little bit. Let's just dive in just about your eating disorder. When did it start? And when did you notice it was a problem?
So I remember noticing comparing my body to somebody else's at the age of seven. I would never say that I had an eating disorder at that point. I think I just was very aware of comparison at that point. My eating disorder, though, didn't really start out with comparison. I kind of fell into it from sports. So another thing about my upbringing is that I love sports. I did it all growing up. I did gymnastics up till the age of 13, 14. Summer right before freshman year is when I quit. And then at that point in gymnastics, I was working out 20 hours a week, which was a lot. And I was able to maintain a decent weight with eating basically whatever I wanted. And I, at that age, I actually didn't even know what like healthy eating was. I thought, I have chips in my lunch, so I need to finish them because that's what a good girl would do, because she finishes her food. So I didn't even know anything about food. And then my freshman year of high school, I didn't do gymnastics. I was doing tennis and other sports, and I had gained weight. My mom noticed it and thought, the summer after freshman year, so that's 1 year after I had quit gymnastics, she encouraged me and herself to get up and run a mile every morning and to try to eat healthier. And I appreciate that because I love running now, and I really didn't know anything about nutrition. However, every eating disorder starts with a diet, and I did go on a diet of some sort. I did. It was labeled as a lifestyle change, I think, but there were foods that were not allowed, foods that certain combinations that were allowed, and you eat at certain hours in between. And I fell into this pattern of always being aware of what I was eating, when I was eating it, what the next point I would be eating would be, and when I would, what, like, it was an opportunity to eat later, and what I was going to do. At that point, I wouldn't say that I had an eating disorder either, although it was, my habits were becoming very ritualistic, and I was getting, I was losing weight, and I was getting great compliments. People were noticing, and so I thought, oh, this is a good thing. I got to keep this up. I guess maybe at that point it was, could be labeled as disordered eating, or just kind of a weird relationship with food, with being very rigid as far as what I would and wouldn't eat and when. I began cross country, my kind of midway through the cross country season, fall of my sophomore year, and I loved it, and I did decently well for somebody who hadn't run, and I had the goal in mind that, oh, this would be great to run for BYU. I can't remember how I thought of that, but that became a goal of mine at that point. The talk about weight does come up in running. I'm out of the sport now, and I think it's gotten a lot better at managing that, but I think there's still ways to go. And social media, I think, has done a great job at allowing professional runners and experienced runners to talk about issues with weight and running, and how that's something that should not be as focused in running, and how women's bodies are different than men's. That's a whole other topic I could talk about, but at my age, I was interested in getting better, and I wanted to learn how to do that. So I read books, and there were some books that talked about racing weight and running weight and what your ideal weight was. And I saw this number, and I saw my height in this table, and I said, okay, I think that's gonna, I should try to go for that, because I did weigh myself. And so I did that, and I worked hard on being even cleaner with my diet or other things, and I got down to that weight. And I did, like, when you do run at lighter weight, it does feel better, because you're not carrying as much. To a certain degree, it feels better. During the off season after cross country, my junior year, I got a foot injury in my right foot, and I was unable to run for many months, and fell.
And this is your junior year of college.
Sorry, junior year of high school.
High school. Okay.
Yeah. So it was the year after I started running, okay, in general.
Your junior year.
So I had that injury, and I wasn't able to run for many months. And I actually, there's a combination of things that happened. One of my good friends from high school, who played another sport, got injured. And I saw her gain weight through her injury. And I was just like, okay, that's not going to happen to me. I worked really hard at getting to this fitness. I do not want to mess with that again. So I'm going to be really careful while I'm injured, because I wasn't able to run. And in my mind, I knew, okay, running is like one of the best ways to burn calories faster than any other form of exercising. And so now that I can't run, it's going to take more exercise to burn the same amount of calories I used to burn. And I didn't want to gain weight because I still had this BYU dream. And so I said, okay, in order to, and I just had this mentality like, okay, in order to be better after this injury, I'm not going to be heavier, so I'm going to watch more what I eat. And I cross-trained and restricted my food a lot, in combination with going through an actual depression. Like, I had other hard things that had happened up in my life where I was sad, but I really think and pretty much know for sure that during this time I was in a depression, which had a whole different other influence on how I was functioning. And this eating disorder, and at this point, I do think it was more of an eating disorder rather than just ritualistic and disordered eating, because I held on to this more rituals, and I was really up. I would get really, not necessarily like angry upset, but I was really inside upset if something went wrong, and I really depended on this way of living, as I felt like I couldn't control a lot of what I wanted to control.
When you said when something went wrong, are you talking about in your diet or
with my injury? So when I got injured, I'm like, okay, now this is derailing my goals of being able to train and run for BYU, which was my dream. And that was like the most important thing in my life at that point. A lot, I mean, you know, besides family and some other stuff, but that was the main thing in my life that I would, if I go back at all my journals, I like all my journal entries about races that I a race every week and what my goal was. And so that was like my main dream and what I felt like I wanted to, and that was taken away from me. So I felt kind of out of control. And then this was a way to keep control. So I think that's like when it started. And then I didn't realize it. And then at some point I thought like, okay, there is something wrong with this. I don't feel well. I looked at myself in the mirror and I'm like, you are really thin. But I couldn't really let go of it. And then actually I heard other people kind of talking about it. A physical therapist, all great intentions, just some other voices from, family friends or whatever that had talked to my mom, and my mom said, oh, you know, there's some people that are concerned. And then that somehow made me feel defined by that. And so I actually even held harder to those practices and just thought, okay, well, this is what I am. So I'm messed up. And then it kind of got worse.
That's so interesting that, well, first of all, because I think it goes to show that every eating disorder looks different for every person.
For sure.
And every story is different. But you looked in the mirror and you were able to notice how thin you were and that it was an unhealthy thin. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But you held on to it more because of the control aspect, mm-hmm. as opposed to I want to be thin, I want to be skinny, because you're, as you expressed, your eating disorder was more related to sports and what you could achieve. And when you kind of lost this sense of control with your injury, that's when you really kind of dove into the eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's what throttle. I held on to. And yeah. At that point, I don't even think it was all by choice to hold on to it. It was just, that's what I did. And that's kind of just what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about, so you said people had mentioned concern, a lot of people, your mom talked to you. So, and then you held on to it harder. So how did you get to the point where you were like, okay, I'm ready for help? What happened? Do you remember?
So I had my eating disorder for 8 years, and there were all different phases of kind of when I was wanting help, when I wasn't. I just thought that I was a very disciplined individual, and that if I wanted to get over this, I could just get over it. So I think, like, in my head, I didn't necessarily ask for help. I just thought, okay, I'm going to work on this myself, which didn't work at all. Towards the end of my senior year of high school, before I was going to go to BYU, my mom had found a therapist, and I had met with him 2 or 3 times, and he was great. He was very helpful. I still, to this day, remember some of the things that he said to me that really stuck out, but I was going to BYU, so I couldn't really continue that relationship too much. I maybe could have talked to him on the phone, but this was back like in 2004, way before cell phone,
telehealth. Like, I don't know how much.
Smartphones, maybe, yeah. Video chats, all those things. And so, yeah, telehealth, I think, at least. So, and then I went to BYU and kind of just didn't get help at all. I did have one roommate who caught me purging my freshman year, and she actually had an eating disorder and kind of encouraged me, but I wasn't motivated to reach out for help at that point. I had another other roommates in my junior year of college who reached out to my bishop and had concerns, and he reached out to my mom, and she's like, yeah, but that didn't really go anywhere because I wasn't ready to get help yet. Mm-hmm. So there was people with good intentions. It wasn't until my first year of grad school that I actually started getting help. And the thing that started it was, I think I was in Utah for Thanksgiving with family. I think that's what I was there for. And my sister lived in Utah at the time, and my parents were up visiting I was not a good person to my sister. Something that happens with eating disorders is, it's a, at least from my experience, it's a brain disease, and it affects a lot of parts from you. It affects you physically, it affects you spiritually, it affects you emotionally, it affects how you treat other people, particularly people that are close to you. And it, for me, it like hardened my heart and made me really numb. I guess maybe numb's a really good word for it. And I don't know what got into me. I think there was some jealousy there or something with my sister, and I just flat out ignored her. And it really hurt her. And I knew what I was doing. But there was also like some weird like possessed part of me, I think. Maybe not possessed, but just something that was still out of my control, but somewhat in my control. It was just like, okay, this isn't me, but I'm the one who's doing it. And my parents saw what's happening. And they took me, and we were staying at my aunt's house. I still remember this conversation very vividly. Shut the door. I was sitting on the bed. My parents stood in front of me. My dad was exasperated and just was like pacing. He's like, "You are so self-centered." And just, you know, I have a really great relationship with my parents. That was something completely out of love. And I knew it at the time. And I was actually really grateful. And I didn't like lash out back. I just said, "Okay, like, help me. How do I be better?" And that's when I realized, like, okay, this thing is taking way too much control. And at this time, so I went to grad school in Seattle, Washington, at University of Washington. And I was just like, okay, it's time to like really kind of get this down. Because in my life, in my mind, I said, okay, there are things that I want in my life that I don't think I can get until I get over this. And it's up to me to really put forth the work. What I've been trying to do isn't working. I can't do this on my own. So I'm going to reach out for help. I think it was helpful that I was in Washington. The rest of my family was in Utah and Arizona. And then I had a brother who was on the East Coast at the time. He still is there. I think it was helpful to feel isolated, like this was my own thing and that I could do this without people near me. So it was, that next quarter up at school, my second quarter of grad school, which was the first of 2009, I went on to the National Eating Disorder Association website to try to find providers. And I wanted, one thing that was important to me was I wanted to find an actual physician, a doctor, because I have felt like I had kind of ruined my insides. My eating disorder looked different throughout the years. Started out with restrictive eating and intense exercise. I don't know if that's technically exercise bulimia. I don't know. And then it wasn't till later when people started talking more about it that I started purging. And so I had this kind of non-specific eating disorder, and I just felt like I had ruined my insides. I still loved running. I would still do it. And I just felt like, oh, something is not quite right in there, and I really want to get it physically checked out. So I filtered out the provider list on the National Eating Disorder website, which is also, that organization is also known as NEDA. And I found a physician in my area who happened to be a sports doctor and happened to be close enough for me to get to. When I was living in Seattle, I didn't have a car. So I just said, okay, I'm going to call her. And of course, she had a long waiting list and she was self-pay and everything. But I was like, no, I want this person, because I think there was only like one other eating disorder specialized physician in the area. It was further, and I was more attracted to this one. So I called this physician's office to schedule an appointment. So I go to her and initially feel really good about her. she was in this neighborhood not far from the university. It took me a bus and a transfer to get there, so not too bad. And I went there. I feel like she was a great fit for me for a number of reasons. She was a sports doctor, so she got the athletic side, and she did specialize in eating disorders. That was one of her specialties. She was a scientist. In my mind, I call her a scientist because she actively did research on metabolism and eating disorders and just other sports-related things. So she was very active in the kind of the new information and finding out information herself and just really analytical that way. And she would tell me about the findings, and she was great. She wasn't super like fluffy with her bedside manner, which was great. I just like wanted to know the facts and be confident in her competence and everything. And she was awesome. I remember the first initial consult, I told her all my story. She was typing frantically. I still have my chart notes from her. And she just knew my history, wanted to know everything. One thing that stuck out to me, which I don't think this is what everybody does in the eating disorder treatment world, but it was super helpful for me and I feel like made all the difference. After hearing my story, she just said, "You know you can get cured from this, right? You can get cured." And in my mind, I was like, she used the C word. That just made the whole difference. Because other people, I think in the eating disorder world, kind of think it's something that just always needs to be managed. And maybe that's true for some people. I want to believe that Dr. Cooper, my doctor, says that to all of her patients, because I, just from personal experience, as a patient hearing that, that was very empowering and extra motivating for me to get like my buns going and working on this, because if this is a cure, I'm going to get there like sooner rather than later. And it was just my goal. She had a program where she was the doctor. She was kind of like the case manager. I would meet with her once a month. I would do blood work once a month, and then I would follow up with her the next week and go over my blood work. I also, at the beginning, met with a nutritionist once a week, just at her office that she knew, but they were independent. I think they were just, you know, partnered in some way, but very independent practices. And then I also met with a psychologist or a therapist once a week for the first while. So I got a lot of help from different aspects. The blood work that she did was a bunch of, I don't even know everything, but she took measurements of different hormone levels and vitamins and other things, so to try to get my body more in line, which I felt very good about. And she would track it so we could see if my levels were improving. She had graphs for me. It was awesome, and I could see, like, motivate myself. And I did get weighed every month, but I was not allowed to see the weight, which is great. And it didn't really matter. It probably did matter to them since they measured it. It didn't matter to me. The way that she framed it was that this is a brain disease, and your body is, your hormones and other things are out of line. When we can get those in line, your brain will be at a better place to think correctly and to overcome this. So that's what my treatment initially looked like for me, and that's how and when I asked for help. Eventually, I didn't need to see the nutritionist up every week, or I stopped doing that. She was very helpful. I still remember some of the things that she told me that are kind of lines that I just remember, and the same with the psychologist. I actually ended up stopping seeing her because my insurance didn't cover it anymore, but luckily that ended up being a good time where I felt like I got a lot and I was okay.
When did you know that you were in a better place?
So I think thought-wise, I was in a good place. I did still see my doctor for longer than the psychologist and the nutritionist. I just noticed, so some of it's just like, yeah, I don't purge anymore, or I purge way, 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 way less. And if it happens once, it's not happening again. So if I did relapse, it's like, okay, it was like a one-time thing. And and I knew I had the tools in my head to recognize what was happening and to combat it. Mm-hmm. And I was eating better. I had a better relationship with different types of foods. Just my mind was like, okay, nothing's off limits. I have a better relationship. I had a better relationship with my body. I was the heaviest I had ever been at that point and loved my body the best, the most I had ever loved it. So that was also a good indication. I just truly endeared it because it was mine. And I just realized, and I had a whole different paradigm shift with, okay, the body is not something to look at. It's a vehicle to do everything I want to in life. And it's such a blessing.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, just thought-wise, it was better. Going to the doctor, though, she'd report, and I knew that some things needed to be still worked out with my levels. So that was kind of like other measurements where I knew I wasn't ready for that. Maybe she did fully discharge me at one point. I actually don't remember that part. There's something else that really helped in my recovery that was also a turning point. Remember, my treatment started like March of 2009, and I feel like I had made great strides in a pretty short amount of time, like even in 3 months, and partly because I was very motivated and in a point of my eating disorder life that I was super angry at my eating disorder and everything that I saw that it was, how much of a hold it had on my life and what it was doing. And just had a really idea of wanting to not have this anymore and feeling like that was possible. So fast forward to, I think, around June, so 3 months later, it was summer in Seattle. I was approaching my first internship season of that up there where people would come to Seattle for internships. There was this one girl that was looking, we had an opening in my house, and there's this one girl that came to check it out to see if she could live there. And then at some point, maybe it was even that day, I don't know, shortly after, I think, I had asked her, so what brings you to Seattle? Why are you here this summer? And she said, oh, well, I'm doing an internship at the National Eating Disorder Association, which is headquartered in Seattle. And I just said, oh, okay, well. And I just pretended I didn't really know what she was talking about. She moved in. She's super cute, great friend. And afterwards, sometime down the road, I just asked her, so what got you in? Like, why were you interested in that type of internship? And she said, oh, well, I had an eating disorder when I was younger, and I'm recovered, and I just want to help people. And I just said, well, can I tell you something? She's like, yeah. I'm like, I'm currently going through treatment right now. And she was just ecstatic for me, so happy. And she was such a great influence in my recovery. First, just I had this model of somebody who had my problem, who has no trace of it, and was super positive and knew exactly, maybe not exactly, but pretty much what I was going through, what my mind was, and other things. She was a great support system. At that point, I had told a couple of my close roommates as well, and then my family knew I was going through treatment. So I just had a few people that I loved and trusted that were really in my corner, that knew what I was doing, and that was just helpful for me. This girl, she was supportive. She'd send me like a song that would help about something. And then she gave me, I think maybe it was for my birthday, because my birthday's in end of June. She gave me a book called Life Without Ed. That was a present to me. And she's like, hey, this book is great. And that book actually was a turning point for me in my recovery. It's written by a girl who was who had an eating disorder too. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I read it. But she might have been writing it while she was going through treatment, but she would have her sections, and then there would be like commentary by her therapist. And in the book, she talks about how, so the book is called Life Without Ed. She personifies an eating disorder, and you can call your eating disorder whatever you want. She called hers Ed. And she talked about how it's a separate person and that you can identify its voice, and you can identify it, and then you can have a conversation with it, and then you can choose actually what you want to do, which made sense to me, especially since earlier I was just like, you know, this isn't me. I can't, I'm doing this, but I feel like I'm not the one who's doing this. But somehow it's, I just did, it didn't make sense to me. And so with this perspective, I'm like, okay, this makes so much more sense now. I feel better about myself. But also this was like a whole other tool to help me really combat it. And that was like when my recovery even accelerated more with being able to kind of get over it. So that was really sweet with having that.
Totally. I love that. And I love so much of what you shared too, because I feel like it's helpful for people who have an eating disorder, but also any addiction or are going, you know, just having that personification that you look at is like, no, like this isn't me, this is that. And being able to recognize the thoughts that are coming into your mind and separating that from yourself. So yeah, I really appreciated that. You talked about how your eating disorder really impacted your relationships, specifically like with your family. Mm-hmm. What other ways had you noticed, I guess, your eating disorder impacting relationships? Because I know you've told me before you would have never wanted to date. Like you would have, it would have been horrible for someone to date you in that state. Like mm-hmm. why, what was happening? Does that make sense?
Yeah. That numbness really does affect, I think affected my ability to relate and attach to people. And something else that's tied into, I think most eating disorders, definitely mine, is perfectionism. And I was a very driven person who had all these goals and who prioritized goals over people. And so I think that tied in, I don't know where one starts and one separate and one ends with eating disorder and perfectionism. So that affected some of me, where I didn't prioritize relationships as much as like achievement and yeah. And I guess my obsession, but just some things where that was what I cared about. And I didn't have the wherewithal, I think, to really connect with people because of that numbness. I had read somewhere, I think, that about when your eating disorder starts, that's when like your dating maturity ends. I mean, that's like where your dating maturity is stuck. So my eating disorder, I'd say, probably started when I was 16. So I think by the time I was like college age, when I was trying to date people still and get into that life, I was early 20s, still stuck in like that 16-year-old dating mentality. And so that wasn't at all preparing for a long-term relationship or anything. That was still like fun and games, I think, in my mind, and very service level. And, you know, probably some, and I do think some 16-year-olds were probably a lot deeper and able to connect to people way more than I was at 16 or 21. but I knew this was a problem. I knew it affected a lot of my thoughts because it was what I would thought about all day. And I didn't want, for dating purposes and long-term relationship, I didn't really want somebody to have to deal with that.
Yeah.
In my head, I had like different things I thought that I needed to fix in myself in order to get married. And getting over my eating disorder was definitely one of them, because I just felt like it was hindering a whole lot.
Well, it sounds like the main, just kind of with that question of how did it impact your relationships, and you've already said this, but it sounds like the main impact was really the numbness and mm-hmm. lack of ability to attach to people, which I think is really interesting.
Because mm-hmm. it also affects your way to empathize.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what advice would you give to someone who is maybe like, and this is an interesting question, but experiencing an eating disorder, because maybe they don't know it right now, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, or maybe they're at the point where they're reaching out for help. But what advice would you give to someone maybe there, or maybe who's struggling with any addiction or, you know, type of disorder? Mm-hmm. What advice would you give them?
It's tricky because I think everybody's experience is different. Like I know what my experience is.
Yeah.
But there's other people's that I don't. And eating disorders can happen for any reasons. My main thing was sports, and maybe like a little trauma of getting injured and having my dreams crushed as a teenager and feeling like I didn't have control over that. Whereas I know other people's disorders can start from like real actual like bigger trauma. And that just makes it more complex, I think. So I I can't, and I'm not a therapist, I'm not a professional. So I think some advice I would give is, I don't know, for me it was super helpful to realize like, okay, this, I am still a good individual, and this eating disorder is a different entity that is out, like, within me, but outside of me. It's not my, I am not this person. That's,
it's not your identity.
Yeah, that's my identity. I'm not the one, like, my inner, like, essence of myself, my goodness, like, the goodness that all of us have, like, this is not me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people believe in the devil and Satan, but I do. And once I realized what this voice was and the things that it was telling me, I realized, gosh, that's a lot like Satan.
Yeah.
Which was kind of humbling, because I do live a religious life, and I had lived a very religious life up to that point, and tried really hard to have good things in my life and to stay, you know, somewhat pure in a sense with what I let into my mind, what I purposely let into my mind and my habits, what I read, what I listened to, and to realize like this thing just crept up in me. It was pretty humbling, and realizing, oh man, this thing has been with me every day, like almost every moment for years. So just realize, like, if you're going through this, you're a good person, there's goodness about you, there's hope. And it does take a lot of work to change. Try to find something. I don't know, I'm not a professional, so I feel really inadequate answering this, but if there's something that you can find a reason to fight, you're like, find that reason. For me, it was, you know, that message from my doctor saying there's a cure, this hope that life could be different. And I think later on, after I'd gone through recovery or a certain degree of recovery and seeing like, okay, this thing is working, I think I would have told myself when I was younger, like, okay, if you can't do it because you don't love yourself enough to go through recovery and go through that effort, find somebody, if it's a family member or somebody that you love dearly, and do it for them. For me, and that was something that I think could have worked for me, if somebody told me, it's like, I know you don't want to do this, like all those years where in college my roommates, you know, said something and I just didn't want to do it because I didn't want to go through that. I think I was like, well, it's now's not the time. Maybe if somebody said, hey, like, maybe do it for your mom or somebody that's like really dear to you. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's something that I know I would have told myself.
Yeah. And we know you're not a professional, but it's your experience, mm-hmm. and just based on your experience. So you've talked, you know, you've kind of your perspective and your advice on helping people who maybe are experiencing this. What about for you, just having experienced it, what advice or what was helpful to you that your family did, and maybe what advice would you give to family and friends who are seeing someone who might have signs of an eating disorder?
So I think watching and being close to somebody with an eating disorder, I think must be really hard based on looking back at my situation and kind of how I knew I was, and some cases how I treated some of my family members, but then just also how kind of engulfed I was in the eating disorder. I think one thing I would tell people who are around, and this is hard to, but don't take some of the things personally that happen. Realize that there's maybe not as much meaning behind what they're doing as you think it is, especially directed at you. Something that I would wish, and I've told my mom this, so she's fine. And we're all, my family and I are in a great place, even my sister, that I was a total not a good person to. We are very close. But something that I was wishing my mother would do, had done, was research the disorder, and just to kind of get an idea of what I was going through. I just was like, oh, I would love it if she would like pick up a book and read about it. Because I was reading about it, maybe not the best books, but I was just like trying to find information. And I think I would have felt a little bit of support there. After I'd gone through a bunch of my recovery, I did give all my family members a book, a copy of Life Without Ed, and asked them to read it for a number of different reasons. Mainly, at that point, I had just become an aunt, and I didn't want anybody, especially within my family, my future kids or my sister's kids or any of my nieces and nephews, to have gone through what I went through. And there are different things that I think would have been helpful to not talk. Like, I would love it if we'd stop talking about bodies. Bodies are as far as like being, they're wonderful, they're vehicles, they're awesome, but I think we put a lot of emphasis in society about what bodies look like. And I don't know it from the guy's perspective. I assume this can happen to them too, but as girls, I think we hear it from like a very young age, like from our mothers and other things, and we don't even realize it's happening. It's just socialized into us to care about the way we look and notice other people and how they look. There's this movement called Beauty Redefined on Instagram, and they have a book. I think, I don't remember the name of it, but I haven't read it, but I follow their Instagram page, and a lot of the things that they say I agree with, and I think would be really important for us to develop that paradigm where bodies are not ornaments. They're beautiful. They are beautiful in the way that they are, and they're functional and are, yeah, great things that way. So I think whether or not you have somebody in the house with an eating disorder, don't talk about bodies, about weight and looks and stuff. And I know that's hard because sometimes maybe people do need to kind of get healthier and maybe lose a little bit of weight, but I don't know, talk to a professional on a way to do that without creating a diet culture that would that would yield into an eating disorder, whether or not you like with any intentions, because mine totally started from that. Also, yeah, so that was one of the reasons why I wanted them to read it, was to prevent it from happening more in my family. Another reason, I would also encourage other people to read about the eating disorder so you have a little bit of a grasp, understanding of what they're going through, while still realizing that maybe what you're reading doesn't make sense, because I can totally understand why some of the thoughts that go through somebody with an eating disorder's brain, or maybe another addiction's brain, they don't make sense. They sound crazy. They're nonsensical, but they're actually real to the person that's thinking them. And just kind of respect that and realize like, okay, I just think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. Another thing that was helpful while I was going through recovery from my family was that I knew they supported me, but they didn't ask about it. It was always a thing. It's like, okay, I will tell you what I want to tell you and when I want to tell you. And then they never asked about anything. So that was also very helpful to feel like, okay, I'm not being hounded. This is my personal project. Yeah. And I have their support.
No, I think that's really good advice. And then kind of going along, you've talked about, you know, giving this book, that's a proactive thing you've done to kind of help your family. What are things you do actively or don't do to kind of help yourself in, you know, recovery?
So things that I'm doing proactively, I'm 12 years down the road. I actually don't feel like I'm really doing anything proactively, because I feel like I've truly changed. I don't think, so recovery was, I'm in a, like when I got to the point of where I thought I was in recovery was like a better place than I even imagined it to be. My paradigm had completely shifted. The other thing had shattered. Like I felt like I was seeing like real life for the first time, and like real life in the meaning that it was supposed to be meant. Like, yeah, starting from, you know, 7 years old, having a little bit of body comparison. I don't know if that's called body dysmorphia at that age or not. And then like finally at age, what was that? 23, 24. Being like, oh wow, this is a whole different life. I've never lived this way. This is like really living. And I think to get there, obviously I had to do things to prevent relapses while I was going through recovery. So telling myself like, okay, as I was like, if I was tempted to purge or whatever, just say, okay, just sit here, like ride the wave kind of thing. Just like things that my nutritionist would tell me. I got to the point where I just love my body because it's mine. I don't care what it looks like. I really don't. I don't diet at all. I think I tried Whole30 once, actually, and that was awful. And I realize some people maybe need that, but I don't know. That's a whole different profession. I don't diet at all. If I want chocolate, I'd eat chocolate. If I don't want if chocolate is in front of me and I really don't feel like eating it, I don't eat it because I know I can eat it anytime I want. So I don't need to eat it then. There was one time where I did notice a familiarity with some thinking. It was actually after a breakup.
Really interesting. Yeah.
It was after a breakup in LA. And this particular breakup was like I don't know why this one was, but it was kind of the biggest heartbreak I had had up to that point. And I physically couldn't eat solid food. I couldn't swallow. I got to the point where I'm like, okay, I can eat grapefruit. I don't want to talk about what I ate, but I ate grapefruit and smoothie and just stuff that didn't involve chewing. And then I would just lose my appetite. And I'm like, well, and I talked to some other friend who had gone through like a worse breakup than I had. And I just said, this is weird. I've never done this. She's like, just trust your body. It's okay. I'm like, okay. And so I think I went like 1 or 2 weeks without eating, not by choice. That was like, my body was making the choice for me. And then I think it was week 2 or something. At that point I realized like, okay, I could choose to eat because my body is going to let me. Or I could choose to, oh, this is like a hunger feeling I'm used to. And like, I can choose to deprive my body. And at that point I had realized, oh yeah, this is familiar to me, this mindset of like choosing to deprive my body because something is out of my control. I recognized that and realized like, okay, no, that's like stupid. I'm not going to like that. That was more of like not, I wasn't tempted at all, but that was an interesting experience to be like, oh, I remember this feeling and thought and realized, but I had the tools to be like, no. Oh, and I had the perspective like, hey, I know that thing ruined me and I'm still angry about it. And I can eat and it's going to be okay. But also I don't want to say scientifically because I'm not a scientist with this way, but just remembering what my doctor said, okay, your brain needs certain nutrients and certain levels in order to work. If it doesn't work, then if you're not there, it's not going to work. And so I'm like, okay, I want to keep my brain healthy, so I'm going to eat.
That's great. Do you have any other things that you, when you're going through recovery, that you still actively like don't do? Like I know we talked a little bit about social media.
Oh yeah, we did. So that's, and I guess like for me, my perspective with stuff is like, I don't necessarily do some of these things for preventative for relapsing. I do them because I'm still very angry at that way of life that I had, and I despise it. I'm disgusted with it. And so I recognize things that are unhealthy for me, to do. And one of them is, yeah, if there's a social media account that, focuses on bodies, I don't follow it. Like, and you know, I don't follow men. I'm a female. I usually follow females on like female influencers, or if I do, and mostly they're just athletes. But you know, if there's like an Instagram account that the main pictures are this awesome looking body and that's obviously what they're flaunting, I don't follow it because I think it's unhealthy. I don't feel like I'm at risk for that, but I don't want to support that kind of person. And it just doesn't bring light to my life.
Yeah. You've talked about so many ways that you've been able to find healing. And with Finding Unity, the podcast, we talk about finding unity through healing, seeking understanding, connection, and love. You've shared a lot of those stories already. Is there anything else you wanted to add about ways you've found that unity through healing, seeking understanding, connection, and love?
Well, I think I've, you know, being somebody who was on the edge of, who was on the side of numbness, and just realizing how wonderful people were that I could count on that still loved me despite what I thought of myself and maybe how I really was. I think to me, that, I don't know, just thinking about unity and knowing that this is your podcast, one thing that I think it's a requisite for unity is love, mm-hmm. and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And realizing that we are capable of doing that and that there's benefit from doing that, not always fighting and not always seeking revenge, but just realizing, yeah, we don't have to get even with each other. We don't have to keep score. But the thing that really unifies us is love, because love is really powerful. When I saw people loving me, that influenced me to love more. When I saw people forgive me, that was an example of like, oh, I need to forgive other people because I have imperfections, and we all do.
Yeah. And, you know, I always ask people when they're on the podcast, what does unity mean to you? And I feel like you've pretty much answered it. Mm-hmm. It's love and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And is there anything else I missed or anything else you wanted to add on what unity means to you?
I think that's what a lot is. And I think as we do that, we grow closer with one another. I really believe that. I've seen that in my life. And, you know, I think, you know, looking back at 2020 and seeing all this division that happened, I listened to somebody who, but she, okay, so she, you know, during 2020, when some of stuff was happening with, we were looking at our history through the lens of, or kind of picking at the racism and current events that are, were going on that, could have been, you know, that were based on race, or that was something that this African-American woman that I said that I think really just stuck out to me, was there's a higher love that we have got to practice. And I'm just like, yeah, she's right. And she was Christian, and I'm Christian. I believe in Christ, and I really do believe that as we approach him, and we can give our burdens to him, and he's the one who has felt all of our pain. And so there is somebody that has felt all of our pain. There is somebody that is even with us. Maybe not the person that you want to be even with you, but he is that person, and he is that for everybody. And so I think, yeah, if we're seeking unity, we do have to reach for that higher love where we have faith that love and forgiveness actually do make a difference, and that takes some humility and real effort. But once you do it, it actually gets easier, or life is easier. You still have to do it over and over again. Every time's hard, but once you do it, it's easier on the other end.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing your story and your perspective and your advice, Coralie, and your thoughts on unity. I really appreciate you being on and being vulnerable and talking about this.
Well, thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like it on whatever platform you're listening to. Remember that it's okay to disagree. Unity comes when we can agree to disagree while still maintaining a love for one another. For more on unity, follow us on Instagram at finding.unity or on Twitter at finding_unity.